Affairs Committee to order. And it has been a frustrating afternoon of delay and delay and delay, but we do have amendments ready now. But now we have a problem that some of our members need to be leaving at quarter after, three of our members. And so we will do the best we can. We will, get as far down the calendar as we can to get the schedule and do what we can do today. But we do have Senator Starr here. We will open the work session on Senate Bill 1336. Senator Shannon?
There are two amendments in front of you. The last one amendment comes from the county clerk. They simply add the word certified in front of certified copy of a marriage certificate, just clarifying language. There are some dash two amendments that were drafted after the Senate committee met. Address some of the concerns that were brought up, and their representative will cover the comments.
Okay.
Marilyn Shannon, Senator in District 15. And covenant marriage is a completely voluntary decision made by a man and woman to receive premarital counseling and agree to conditions that make obtaining divorce more difficult. Under a covenant marriage, a couple is committed to working through the most difficult times and, if necessary, receive counseling and find fault before a final decision is made for dissolution of the marital vows. A covenant marriage promotes informed, well-thought-out premarital decisions and creates a higher standard for divorce. On July 14, 1999, Senate Bill 1336, Covenant Marriage, passed the Senate with 19 ayes to 10 nays with one excuse. In Oregon now, two-thirds of Oregon adults believe typical marriage in Oregon is weaker than it was 30 years ago. This is from a 1999 Oregon Marriage Report, the Oregon Center for Family Policy. More than one in four, 29% of Oregonians have experienced divorce. Currently, 10% of Oregon adults describe their marital status as divorced. Current law in Oregon allows divorce for any reason at any time. Oregon adults have expressed strong opinions on when divorce is appropriate and when it is not. When asked how the law should govern a situation where one spouse wants a divorce and the other does not, 25% said the current law, which allows divorce with no penalty, was appropriate. However, more than half, 55%, of the adults in this state selected options that are more restrictive than current law. More than four out of every five people, 82%, say a couple who are unhappy in their marriage should remain together and work to reestablish the love they once felt, while only 16% said the couple should get a divorce. Oregonians clearly believe children are better off when raised by a married mother and father. The difficult part of this bill is finding fault. No-fault marriages, good or bad, have created a test drive mentality. Herma K. Hill, a principal backer of California's no-fault divorce legislation in 1969, later offered a mournful observation on marital meltdowns. She said, "Divorce by unilateral fiat is closer to desertion than to mutual separation." The logical argument goes that fault never really disappears from divorce proceedings. It just insinuates itself into battles over alimony payments, division of property, and child custody, all of which need court proceedings which ascertain levels of blame or fault. More importantly, divorce law should contain notions of objective fault to signal society's approval of certain kinds of behavior, most notably spousal or child abuse. Society's disapproval is what I said. The opposite can be said about no-fault marriages that increase the likelihood of domestic violence by failing to identify and punish individuals that abuse family members or commit other serious crimes. Domestic violence is a clear ground for divorce under covenant marriage. Covenant marriage laws would not hold couples in abusive relationships. There's plenty of abuse and adultery in our society. However, it can be argued that couples feel much more realistically with their lives when they face the issue of fault where it can be identified. And now to this bill, the burden of proof under Senate Bill 1360, covenant marriage, is only a preponderance of the evidence, meaning just over 50% at fault must be met and is the burden of proof used in civil trials. Very contentious issues such as mandating an evidentiary trial after summary judgments have been stricken from this bill. We wrote it once and this is in the rewriting. Definitions of specific terms have been included in the bill, such as adultery, abuse, and habitual intemperance. I would just like to say one reason that I became involved in this is that across the country there are cities where the ministerial associations have agreed to do only covenant marriages, which is premarital counseling and divorce counseling if they choose a divorce. And the divorce counseling is so that both parents understand what divorce does to children and how they need to stay involved in their lives, etc. Sacramento, California, and Kansas City that I know of, the divorce rate over 11 years, one place, 10 years another, the divorce rate dropped by 35%. This is a good deal for families and especially children.
President Gardner?
Yes. Senator, I just had one question for you. You said that there were certain areas where ministers had agreed to only perform these marriages. So are you saying that there's nothing in this bill that would prohibit a particular church or a particular minister from refusing to perform a service unless it was a covenant marriage?
Yes. However, they would receive a covenant marriage from the county court, and our bill is patterned after two other states where they could not have a no-fault divorce. And that's not in the these ministerial association agreements.
Yes, Ms. Gardner.
But basically what you're saying is that this is permissive, but that if an individual church or an individual minister said, you know, the only marriages that shall be performed in this church or performed by me as a minister would be covenant marriages, there's nothing that bill that prohibits them at all from doing that.
I didn't make it clear. That counseling, but not the no-fault divorce. That's what a law has to address, that, not a minister.
I don't think you got the question. Let me try. Senator Starr, Senate District 5, there's nothing in this bill that prohibits an individual church from performing covenant marriage as they understand it. And in reality, churches throughout history have performed covenant marriages. And in fact, we didn't begin to bring marriage into the civil law statutes until, I think, 17th or 18th century. It was always a church sacrament. But we continuated the civil government into marriages, and we began to set up different restrictions. And we have gone so far as to, as Senator Shannon has pointed out, to a no-fault divorce. And we feel that because there is strong sentiment in some communities that they perform only covenant marriages, as would be addressed in the statute, they would be enabled also to deliver what is essentially all divorce now. There must be conditions under which the divorce would be granted. And it would establish a separate marriage license form, a covenant marriage license. To receive the license, they must be certified as having received the counseling. I think that significantly, what she said of two cities outside the state has already occurred in Oregon now, and Corvallis became the first city in the state where the ministry voluntarily signed what they called a marriage community marriage compact. And 77 ministers initially signed on to this compact, and they agreed in essence to among themselves that premarital counseling was a prerequisite in order for them to conduct the marriage ceremony. Now, I've had reports from the chaplain at the university, Oregon State University, that first three couples who came to him entered into counseling, and two of the three couples were counseled. They decided they weren't prepared to marry. And that's a good thing. And so it works, but if they also have the opportunity voluntarily to enter into a marriage where they have restrictions on how easy it is to get a divorce, I think it is good for families, it's good for strengthening the marriage, and this bill goes a long ways toward accomplishing that. We have made some substantial amendments from the original bill, which was just a copy of the Louisiana law. And those amendments, some additional amendments brought forward today, we agreed to bring those forward, feeling that they were important components of what this bill might encompass. And it is a voluntary program, but one that addresses probably the most significant problem in society today, and that's broken homes.
Mr. Chair, Gardner,
I understand. I understand what you're saying, Senator, but my question is if the church requires the couple to enter covenant marriage or they won't perform the services, then to me it's no longer voluntary.
The church might require the counseling and all the concepts of that without the couple then seeking a covenant marriage certificate. I think in that regard that it remains voluntary and that the couple does not have to purchase a covenant marriage license. That's what binds them to the effects of the bill.
Whatsoever about premarital counseling. I mean, my wife and I went through it prior to getting married 10 years ago. It's great. I agree with you. But is there anything in this bill that would preclude a church from requiring a couple to go through the entire process of a covenant marriage and covenant marriage certificates, thereby precluding them from having a no-fault divorce?
I understand where you're driving with that. I think that it still remains with the couple the type of license that they get when they go to the county clerk for a marriage license. If the church placed such a requirement, then they could back that up by the power of the clergy or whatever, and I see that what you're driving at is certainly a possibility, but I still think that the couple has them out, and they might not be able to marry in that church though, if the church set such a standard.
Can I get that?
Sure.
And I don't know the answer to this, and maybe somebody does, but can a church in Oregon say, if we marry you under this agreement, it's illegal for you to have a no-fault divorce? That's my question. See, that's why this bill is necessary. He shook his head no. Does the court have the authority, does the church have the authority to require the kind of divorce that you obtain?
Mr. Chair,
Yes, it is. As you point out, there is no requirement in the law today that any church has to marry anyone. And so this does not keep to say that a church under this, or a minister says, well, I'm not going to marry you unless you go through this. That's the same today. A church can require couples to go through anything, jump over any hoop they want them to. There's no requirement that that minister ever has to marry that person. A judge doesn't have that same latitude in the case today. And in this bill, that's still the case. A judge would still have to marry you. If you chose a covenant marriage or that path, you chose no longer that path. This doesn't change any relationship between church and state. Remember, there's a thing called separation of church and state.
And may I just add, you still may purchase a regular marriage license. There'll be two there. And go to a church and say, I agree to the premarital counseling, and they will marry you. This is illegal.
Yeah. I might have to share that. But my point is that, as I recall it, having only been married once and then about 10 years ago, that the minister signs the certificate. Now, if that minister or church says, unless it's a covenant marriage certificate, we're not going to perform the marriage here, we're not going to sign the certificate, then that's not permissive in nature, I guess. To me, that is, you know, that means they have to make the choice of either getting married through a justice of the peace through another church. They can't be married through their church.
Yeah, I answer that. And that is you.
He's correct in that. And that's, but the churches have that same opportunity to change.
Well, I can help with this. If you go to any Catholic church in the state and ask the priest to marry you, the first thing the priest is going to say is, are you Catholic? Is your spouse willing to be married in front of a Catholic priest? Are you willing to go through 6 months of premarital and some churches 9 months or 12 months counseling and all this stuff? And none of that's required in the statutes. If you're not willing to do that, the priest isn't going to marry you. And there's no change from what the covenant of marriage is all about. It happens right now. It's signing that document isn't just a voluntary act for the husband and wife who are married. It's a voluntary act for the minister. And if that minister doesn't agree, you go down the street and you find yourself a judge or a minister in another church, the church of the, I won't say. It doesn't have to be too like the church of Elvis, Las Vegas. So, anyway, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I feel better now.
We had ample opportunity to get our questions answered, so we had this up before us yesterday, and we learned some testimony on the bill. Some people can't get their hands around the idea. Mr. Inquire?
Sure, I move to ask one amendment on the bill. Cause of motion for us from the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1336. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, we have 2 amendments in the bill.
And those came at the request of the Senate Rules Committee, I believe, when they heard the bill. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? Do you object?
Yes.
Okay. Note that Representative Mannix objects, please. Excuse me, no other objections. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I would request for suspension of the rules for a conceptual amendment.
And what would that conceptual amendment be?
On page 3. Line 34 of the bill. Substitute the word relations for intercourse.
Page 3, line 34
of the bill. Are you looking near the citation? Something other than the bill.
Okay.
I think that's a little broader term. And I checked it with Representative Senator Stark's staff. And there's
a few relations for the word intercourse.
Correct.
It's pretty broad. Define relations.
That's the President Clinton to do. This is a Bill Clinton amendment.
I think we're going to the.
There isn't an if in here, is there?
How do you define it? Okay, we do have a request for suspension of the rules, colleagues, for purposes of a contested amendment on line, page 3, line 34. Do we have 5 votes?
Yes.
Okay. I'd be happy to note objections. See no objection. Motion carries. Rules are suspended.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we replace intercourse with relay.
Okay, on line
34 or page 3.
Okay, that's a pretty straightforward amendment, colleagues. Further discussion on the amendment? There's a chance to jump in.
Mr. Chair?
Okay. Yes.
I'm concerned about that without, I mean, I don't have my Black's Law Dictionary down here to see what they would define relations, but that is a really broad word put in this. To say adultery includes sex. I guess you have sex. You got sex. Okay, it's fine. I'm fine.
I'm sorry.
That's the word right in front of it.
Yeah, line 32 is also used in the bill itself. And there's no definition for it there.
No, I forgot the word sexual was right in front of it. I was just thinking any voluntary relationship.
It narrows it considerably.
Yeah, he said. I'm fine.
Pick a movie question.
Oh, we can talk about this more.
Anybody in the audience wish to test the
time? It could be the legislative council that defined that.
Chair Simmons, as we all know, it's hard enough even to define sexual intercourse.
Don't get on that.
Okay. Any further discussion on the proposed conceptual amendment? Rules are suspended. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Yes.
I move the bill as amended to the floor of the House.
Okay, colleagues, have a motion to move the bill as amended to the floor of the House to do pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I will be voting no. I believe there will be one other member voting no. Since this is a relatively significant piece of the legislation, we will usually try to have two no votes if there's any dissension on the floor. I'll print notice for a minority report, but I do not anticipate offering one now.
Listening to Edward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support this today. And, you know, this is one of those I've actually thought a lot about since you brought it to us yesterday. And, you know, I think first and foremost we're talking about it's voluntary. It's not mandated. I guess one could make a case that, is this a superior marriage document and commitment versus what's on the books today? I guess I came around to the fact that it's really a personal choice. I don't feel that, you know, for myself, I would necessarily have taken this if this were the law. I feel that my marriage is fine and would be there to the end. My only concern I had about this, and of course we didn't have a lot of chance to discuss this, was the issue of a minor, and having, basically either a parent or a legal guardian being able to sign up for this. And I don't know if down the road there might be a challenge to that. That is that a legal guardian basically committed you to something, to this covenant, which potentially could have legal ramifications to you as an adult. I'm not a lawyer. I just was questioning whether that makes some sense to have minors involved in this. I guess we'll go with it as it is. But again, I think this is, again, a voluntary thing that people can enter into. And, you know, if the intent is to try to keep people married and they feel like that will help them, then so be it.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Matt.
First, I'd note that a covenant in effect is like a contract here, and the reason for having somebody else serve as a guardian for a minor who you can get married at the age of 17. Legally, that would be unenforceable as a contract, because you have to be 18-year-old would enter into a contract, but the statute allows 17-year-olds to be married under certain circumstances. So by saying that a guardian is in effect stepping in, we're just making sure that we're apparent that the covered contract law principles. As far as the bill generally goes, I'm disappointed to hear that there's two no votes. And if there's this idea of having a minority report, or even the concept of a minority report, I'd be embarrassed to be against this bill. I'd be embarrassed to be against this bill. This is the epitome of a voluntary arrangement between two people who love each other. And we've seen the path that society has followed since we established no-fault divorce in Oregon, which means, in many instances, marriages which are devoid of the kind of commitment that's necessary to make a truly successful marriage. I see this as simply a turn towards rebuilding the meaning of marriage in the state, and I would hope that over time we do something about the no-fault divorce laws so that we can help couples deal with their issues, first of all, through some preparation before they get married, and second of all, once they are married, through counseling, rather than taking the easy way out, which is the way society does it now. We want everything quick and cheap and easy, and for once, we're saying we're going to be supportive of people who make a real commitment to each other. I'm really proud of the presentation of this bill, the support of this bill in the Senate, and again, I guess people just have to make their own policy choices. But to me, it's one of the easiest votes I've had all session.
Thank you, Senator Manning. Please call the roll.
Mr. Tegelmeyer.
Aye.
Representative
Edwards. No, and please notice the conference on my report.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Carter.
No.
Representative
Manning.
Aye.
Representative
Carr. Aye. Representative Carr. Aye. Representative Carr will be the carrier. Motion carries. Pass recommendation. We'll call the roll. On Senate Bill 1336. We do have amendments on, and you guys need to be running your quarters information.
2 minutes. This seems to be one that you're good on. There's a lot of people here.
We have an amendment to be introduced on 1331. We have the A4 and A5. Open a work session on Senate Bill 31. And we have A4 and A5 amendments on 1331, colleagues. Thank you. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1386. We have a set of amendments before. We have A37, then we have A39. And A37, I believe, are Representative Devil.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, did you want me just to give a brief explanation?
That would be fine.
Given the amount of time that we have here tonight, I thought it would be best that I just briefly describe what's in the amendments, rather than going through them section by section. What the amendments basically do that's different from the A39 is they call on the Corrections Division and the Governor to basically do several things. One, to decide the damaged facility. Two, to reopen a siting process, and in that siting process, consider at least three sites. And in addition to those three sites, that's left open which sites that they consider, that they consider the potential use of the Columbia River Correctional Facility to continue to be used for minimum security women. It adds two criteria to the standard for selecting those sites. One, that there be jurisdictional support as a mandatory criteria rather than desirable, and adds a clear definition of what jurisdictional support is. Two, not as mandatory but as desirable, that they not go to a site that requires the use of eminent domain unless it's the only potential site that they would have available. The other thing that it calls for is a process that's somewhat shorter than supersiding, but by no means as short as what the governor wants in his version of the bill, and a fairly defined process in terms of public hearings, and an ultimate decision in approximately about 100 days from passage of the bill.
Very much. Also have the A39 as mentioned earlier.
You want me to describe the A39?
Yeah, that's a good A39. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, the A39s are only slightly different from the A31s. There were three different versions like this. There were the original A11s, which was right directly at Day Road, the A19s, which were, you could see site damage and then select between A or B, site directly at Day Road, or reopen the process. I refer to that as the multiple choice. This is basically the write a short essay and go to Day Road. It's about probably about a 35-40 day process. It clearly, the governor goes ahead, issues an executive order for the DOC to examine a site, does not define what that site will be, does not add any new criteria to how that site will be examined, has a relatively shortened process, but like I say, should be completed within about a 30-day process, and it's a pretty foregone conclusion what the conclusion of that study would be.
There are a number of other sites from the state that have gone through preliminary analysis besides Bay Road, and the A39 do not bind the governor to the Bay Road by any stretch of the imagination, and he still has other options available to him.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would agree with you that in theory, but the governor has made his intentions relatively clear.
So, Mr. Chairman, we certainly cannot bind the governor to any particular action in this matter. We're simply giving him a constellation of choices within the state of Oregon. Sometimes within that constellation of choices, you need to provide the craft by which you can arrive at those choices in an expeditious manner. The A39 amendments are more expeditious at resolving this controversy.
Star?
I don't know that expeditiousness is the goal here. I think that you try to facilitate this thing, that a little time and thought doesn't hurt.
As many of us have cogitated upon the subject for many, many months, in fact, the legislature has dwelt on the subject in the 97 session and in the interim, and at least three committees of this legislature have dealt with the subject. And I know I'm using flowing oratory, but the real point is I think we know that the governor has a particular point of view. We could, I suppose, force him into a particular conclusion, but we've tried to do that, and he has his pen, as I call it, the veto pen, as opposed to the signature pen. And when he uses it, it seems as though he has not been forced to that choice. And we've tried that, and it just doesn't work. At some point, we can allow the governor to take responsibility for his own actions and lay out the cornucopia, if you wish, of choices, and define how those would be arrived at. But at the same time, not give him choices where we would drag out this process unnecessarily, and where we can make sure that appropriate circumstances are considered. That's what we have in front of us with the A39 amendment. Yes, it may well be that the governor chooses a particular site, and he may well be able to expedite the process, but only if the necessary preparation work has been done, and a number of sites qualify for that within the state.
And the number has been pushed to the
My good friend and representative from Salem has been very eloquent in the past about how the legislative body should do what it thinks is best, regardless of what the ultimate decision of the governor is on a particular issue. And I would concur with him in that latter statement. It is true that this body has debated this issue for a relatively long time, but I think this body has always tried to find a reasonable solution that assures due process to everyone within the process. And in fact, I think that
of course, we passed the bill out of here earlier by about a 60-40% margin. Now, this bill does not create really any long, arduous trail. Previous opponents to the damage site often cited that they were making a decision which would last for 100 years. What we're asking the governor now is to take 100 days to make a decision that will last 100 years.
Mr. Chairman.
This is the date.
Yes, I've heard both sides carrying on. I would say that I have another set of amendments that made a definitive choice, and I was willing to stand by them, but in the spirit of compromise in the legislative process, I've backed away from those in order to accommodate the interests of my colleagues both in the House and the Senate. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. And I want you to know there has been some objection to anything that we put forward that does not only unsite and preclude damage as a consideration as a future site, but also that does not preclude the day road site also. Representative Carmel has mentioned some concern to me about that neither site is actually to his liking, but having said that, this is a process that requires a considerable amount of compromise, and we have something before us that does not, at least at this point, is not staring down the barrel of a outright veto. And I have been concerned about perhaps language, finding this language that would say that require a certain acceptance from whatever community it is located nearby. The supersizing process that the legislature gave the governor the authority to use does not require it.
But of course, Mr. Chairman, we understand at this point that the only reason that the legislature is dealing with this is because the governor has asked for a change in the decision he's already made, and he cannot actually change that decision unless he gets legislative authority to do it. I think our resolution to this issue lies somewhere. I don't know who has the dash 38, but lies somewhere between the dash 37s and the dash
39s. Mr. Chairman,
I move adoption of the A39 amendment to the Senate Bill 682.
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my motion to adopt the A39 amendment.
Okay, colleagues, the motion has been withdrawn, and what we are going to do is close the work session on Senate Bill 686 and come back to this at 8:30 tomorrow morning before the floor session and take some testimony, and then we will hopefully be able to wrap up this process and begin moving along at that point. So we will close the work session on Senate Bill 686. You guys need to go?
Yeah.
Probably this is a good opportunity to get
this. And for the end, this thing is considered.
Are you going to do anything? If anything, do it. If it is a unanimous amendment, then that's a unanimous amendment. There's one here.
I didn't make it.
I wouldn't make it.
And what else can we do tonight?
I don't know. I don't know why we can't do
that. I'm ready.
Okay. We are only a partial committee now, but we will go into a public work session on NFL 325. Open a work session on 325.
He's lost the quorum, Mr. Chair.
So we have a forum president who's gone into the work session.
Who did? 325.
We have a forum now. Open a work session on NFL 325.
Mr. Chair members, Steve Delaney is here from Perth. If you'd like him to come forward and explain this bill. Members, for your information, this should go through the Ways and Means Committee, and there is a revenue and fiscal impact bill taken to the Senate SMS.
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Delaney.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Delaney, manager of government relations at PERS. Senate Bill 325 is to allow members that are preparing for their retirement to make a purchase of what we call a full cost service credit purchase during the course of their career, rather than waiting up until retirement. This morning, during the House discussions, you heard Representative Krupp talk about the various purchases available in PERS. 14 different purchases, three of those are full cost purchases, where there's no cost at all to the employer, the member has to make the entire purchase himself. And that's the purchase of time serving in the military prior to coming to PERS, or purchasing time as a teacher in another state, or purchasing time if a person has been out on a non-duty disability. Currently, a person can make those purchases 90 days prior to retirement. They tend to be fairly spendy for someone going out with a formula calculation. They've been running around $50,000 per individual. This purchase would allow a member to say, I plan to retire in 10 years. I'd like to start making that purchase now through a salary reduction. PERS will also be applying to the IRS for a private letter ruling to make these pre-tax if possible. Again, there is no cost to the employers, nor is there any cost to PERS. The administrative costs for PERS were also built into this purchase price by the individual. Let me just give you one example as to why a person might do it. Let's say a person has 27 years of service with PERS and they need 30 to be able to retire. And they had 4 years of military prior to coming to PERS. They could purchase three of those to get the 30 they need. And what PERS would do is we'd calculate and say, okay, if we used your 27 years you have right now, we'd pay you $1,000 a month. Buying those extra 3 years, you're going to get $1,200 a month. You have to pay to PERS that extra $200, pay all the money it takes to pay you that extra $200 over your retirement career, along with the COLAs and any other costs associated with it. That is what a full cost purchase says. And I am available to answer any questions that the committee may have.
I have checked over the fiscal and the revenue impact, and the revenue impact does say that it has potential in the 2003-2005 biennium to reduce general fund revenues by about $200,000 per biennium, assuming that 1,000 participants purchase. And is there any way of accurately guessing how many participants, generally how many are eligible, should we do that?
We have past experience because these have been available since the 97 session. We've been averaging about 1,000 requests for estimates per year, approximately 100 individuals of those begin making the purchase. This obviously would make it more available to individuals by the fact that they could now, instead of doing it 90 days prior to retirement, move over their career.
Okay. So, and the $200,000 cost, is that mainly administrative? Is it that bill?
Mr. Chair, I'm unsure of revenue how that particular sheet works. We first filed the fiscal impact, and the fiscal impact should be a $0 because there is no cost to PERS. On the revenue piece, I'm not sure how that comes to the committee.
Okay.
But as far as the fiscal, the PERS is supplied, it's a $0 cost because full cost means the person must pay for the administrative fee.
I have one other amendment in the like, for consideration by the committee. At the request of Representative Westland, this could be made. I did visit with the Legislative Council. This would fit as a tag on along with the language in Senate Bill 325. This allowed for anyone who held elective office on or after January 1, 1980, an opportunity to purchase retirement credit for all or part of the period of service that he served, and if you pay the full cost and interest, interest is computed at 7.5%. And since receiving this, I've been informed that an amendment similar to this has been around in the past. Have you seen this before?
Mr. Chair, I've not seen this particular one before, no. I am aware that this has been discussed in past sessions.
Okay.
I would
open a 90-day window within which this opportunity would be available, and then it would close and be gone.
Correct. I would clarify also one item that the language is presented here under lines 10 and 11 of page 2 on the interest would not therefore be a full cost purchase, because for full cost, actual interest charges are calculated to the member, and currently PERS is assuming 8% interest when looking into the future. That is the amount that actuary would use. There's a slight.
So if we amended that, we would have to suspend the rules. This is asking for 722.
We wouldn't have to suspend the rules if we haven't paid.
All right, well.
But we're going on to this. It's sitting here. So if you haven't paid, you
know. So.
Sure.
Well. I mean, if you had both, I guess. And but if we were to change the interest rate to 8%, that would be okay.
Yeah.
I don't know that even since it is before.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I did speak with him earlier about this. He indicated it would fit just fine on the end of this bill. Should we change?
Oh, it's just about the interest for this? I'm not sure.
Chair Simmons, Dave Hendricks, Deputy Legislative Counsel's Office. It does fit within the title. This is not a full purchase. The way there are these amendments about this, it's not a full cost purchase for business. The way it was drafted.
Say that again.
It's not a full cost purchase provision. The way these amendments are drafted, the employee contribution that would have been made by the member for the period of service plus 7.5%, which would go into the employee account. Steve has indicated to you, full cost purchases literally represent the full cost to the system of the acquisition, and are very expensive. And plus, you basically get what you pay for, because you pay the full cost and you get the benefits based on what you pay in. The way these amendments are drafted are like the other 13 purchase provisions that are on the book. These are the three that are in the bill now are what we refer to as the full cost ones for the members required to pay the full cost. The 12 or 13 other ones basically allow, a good example is
is the provision that allows a member who withdraws their account, PERS allows you, if you leave public employment, to take your money out. But if you do, you just get your money out, you forfeit everything else that the employer might have been required to pay to you in the way of pension and everything else. If you come back into public employment, you have the right, and if you come back within a certain time, you have the right to acquire the credit, and what you have to do is pay in the amount that you withdrew, basically your employee contributions, the amount you took out. So these amendments are drafted along those lines, and they're not a full cost provision.
Okay, so it may be appropriate to amend these, conceptually, to make this a full cost provision, if we're going to adopt it.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. If you look at the Angelos bill, page 2, lines 27, 28, gives the language that we use for full cost. It states there the full cost of the service credit purchase, including interest, must be paid. This is again lines 27, 28 of the page 2.
Okay. What's the reaction of the committee to the other amendments? Is there any discussion?
I guess, Mr. Chair, that apparently this kind of thing has been offered before, and the folks that just love the facts, unfortunately, aren't here because of the term limits, and in my back to be able to explain why in the past this hasn't been done, because they're not here, because they have no legislative history, so, you know, what kind of, why this wasn't done before, and I, you know, first I've seen it, so I think full cost makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have a strong feeling against.
Mr. Byer, please.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
Mr. Chair. I'd actually like to talk to Representative Westholm about and then secondly, if we did add this on, let's just add at least the word costly came out of somebody's mouth up here. I don't know if that makes it an expensive provision that we're adding on, particularly if it goes to full, we're doing a full reimbursement.
I think if we change it to full cost, then it in effect is allowing them to pay money into the system to buy years of credit. Very similar to what the original Bill 325 allows them to do, and they end up, if it's at full cost, that would include interest and administrative charges on top of full load of cost, in effect. And so there should be no fiscal or revenue impact.
They buy into it, right? I've seen this done before in another session. Obviously, there's probably somebody this is targeted at. But in the past, when I've seen this done, it's usually for somebody who slipped through the cracks somehow and they're trying to get into it. So, I mean, I'd like you, unless you're going to move it, I'd maybe do tomorrow.
Aren't you going to that function?
Yeah, my ride's still out there. Javelin.
Okay. Maybe we could find her through the bus and have her come down.
Just go ahead. I'll be fine.
Be fine. Yeah. Good minute. Should be. Will you run up Manix then? So we can just send the rules.
Yeah, can you hear it with some Manix out of the hallway, please? Is there anybody?
Okay.
Mr. Hunter, could you give a copy of these? Or Mr. Delaney has them behind you. Could you give us the exact wording? That would be necessary for full cost.
First thing we'll do is ask for unanimous consent for to conceptually amend the amendment that was originally prepared for Senate Bill 722 to dash A20s into Senate Bill 325, and then make conceptual amendments to that. Is there any objection to that? Hearing none, to order. We have convention. Now, would you give us some assistance here? You want to make it full cost charge.
Yes, Chair Simmons, you have before you some amendments that I have prepared for Senate Bill 722-A20. The change would be simply on page 2 of those amendments, on line...
Did we adopt the amendments?
Yeah. On line 6. Well, frankly, I think the easiest way to do it, let's just say delete lines 4 through 11.
And insert some language.
And then the language that you would insert would be paying to the board in a lump sum for credit to the account of the employee and public employee's retirement fund. And I'm reading this from lines 4 and 5 there on the thing. We're reinserting this. Within 90 days after the effective date of this 1999 Act, comma, the full cost of the credit, of the service credit applied for, period.
Including interest.
Chair Simmons, the other question would be then, do you wish to have them also covered by the option of doing it over a period of time, which is provided by Senate Bill 325? This would, in effect, the only other amendment that would require would be to amend the list of the definition of service credit purchase on page 1 of the bill, and just insert after line 16, basically a new paragraph D indicating purchase of retirement credit under whatever section this ends up in the Act. I think it'll be probably section 14. And I think conceptually, if you want to do that, that's an easy change to make in the rest of the bill. Basically saying you still have to pay the full cost, but you'll be able to do it in the same way these other full cost purchases are handled in Senate.
Then it would be to apply for in that 90-day window, not to pay it in full within that 90-day window.
Correct. Right now, what we have done is in the sections that currently allow full purchases, we've gone on in and indicated that they can pay it in the manner provided by sections 2 to 10. And so we could also do that within this by indicating that, hey, you have to pay the full cost, but instead of saying within 90 days, we just say in the manner provided by sections 2 to 10 of this 1999 Act, and you would be there. So basically, you can pay it as provided in this, which allows for the payoff over the period of your career rather than all in a lump sum at the end.
I ask a question about the amendment not related to the I have a question about, maybe Mr. Delaney is the one to answer this. Is there anyone that holds elective office other than legislative members or statewide office holders that are members of PERS? I mean, are there any other
Chair members? Yes, there are. Elected officials per city, per county, they are elected. They fall within that definition of elected officials.
So, like, Portland City Commissioners?
Yes.
County Commissioners around the state pay at a reasonable amount?
That is correct.
So it could affect a lot more than just former legislators.
Chair members, committee, that is correct.
Mr. Chairman? Yes, it's been moved.
Wouldn't it be more equitable to require that the payment should include, instead of interest, an amount equivalent to the annual rate of growth in the fund for each year that the person would have contributed?
Chair Simmons, Representative Mannix, if we go with the conceptual change we're talking about here to go to full cost, they pay the actuarial
determine the cost of what it takes to provide those benefits. So there's no cost, at least in theory, unless they make an error in their calculations, no cost to PERS, no cost to the employer. The full cost is borne by the employee. And there is no interest that they pay on that. It's a lump.
May I follow up? I don't know if you're understanding me. Say I would have contributed $500 during a given year, and we're saying, well, you've got to put that in plus 7.5% interest. But say the investments in that year were such that the return was 25%. Let's get realistic, 20%. We've seen some outstanding returns. Now, of course, the person took their risks by being in PERS at the time. Right now, aren't we, under the 7.5%, rewarding them by saying that after the fact, they can go back at a cost of 7.5%, get into this 20% return?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mannix, you know, what the full cost is doing, it is after the fact that as the person is ready to retire, what it's saying is, how much are we going to pay you in additional benefits over the rest of your lifetime based on these monies coming in, no matter what interest rate?
We're talking about the amendment here.
No.
I'm not talking about the bill. I have no problem with the bill.
If we go with the full cost, saying the 7.5% comes out of the bill altogether, there's no interest whatsoever.
So they are going to have to pay, in effect, whatever the cost of growth, whatever the returns were to build up to that fund, they're going to have to pay all of that.
Yeah.
And then all they get, bear with me, is pay the federal and state tax advantage of being a participant, which anybody can get. But they're not going to end up paying in less than in their cold, hard cash than someone who has dutifully stayed in the fund and paid in all along.
Mr. Riffman, that is correct.
They will not be paying less.
Under a full cost formula, that is correct.
Okay. I feel better. Thank you.
Okay. So the question remains then, do they want to leave it open to let them pay in over a period of time, or have a 90-day window, and let them pay in full during the 90-day window and then close it?
Yeah. That's the question. That would make it a permanent provision if you did that. So as it now stands, temporary provision. If you want to keep it temporary, you need to not have it under 325 simply because it contemplates just paying the lump sum amount.
So even if it was a couple of additional sections to the bill,
as the amendments are currently drafted, you know, they have to pay it within 90 days after the effective date in order to acquire the credit. Is there any reason why? I think you could do it while leaving it temporary to say, however, you can make the application but pay the amount under 325 over the period of your career. And that would mean this would remain temporary, but it would say, simply say within it, it may be done. Or the other way to do it is pursuant to rules of the board, which is another way which we've handled that issue this session.
It seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that I just say, here's the window of opportunity, jump through the window now, and yes, you can get into the long-term payment process, but if you didn't jump through the window, it's closing in 90 days, and get out of here. And we don't have to sweat people coming in. People later on may decide they'll hold off. I just think that, maybe I won't join PERS. I'll see how it does for a while, and then a year from now I can elect to jump back in. I wouldn't want it to be a continued opportunity to play games.
Okay. So draft that for us.
I can draft it anyway. I can draft that for you.
And
it's not that hard.
I love it. Not too
early, though. I mean, I haven't got anybody in the office tonight.
As long as it's a full meal deal, Mr. Chairman, I'm okay with it. And if it's a short-term window of opportunity to jump back in, okay. And then they can pay out over time. That's not a problem for me. I'm going to pay the full price. Can we call it the Dell clause?
Okay, we will close the public hearing on 10-3-25. and now go to
I guess I shouldn't go there.
We'll open a work session on SGR 11 and call Director Janella.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. You know, he's probably going to have some of that thing that's not taken. So you can have to put it on. Janella, thank you for coming, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Julie Gianella, representative for District 38. Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues, for having a hearing on SJR 11. This resolution is virtually the same as HJR 59, which overwhelmingly passed through the House. The main difference between HJR 59 and SJR 11A is that SJR 11 includes funding for county and city sheriffs. SJR 11 had a strong bipartisan majority vote on the Senate floor, just as HJR 59 did in the House. Right now, Oregon is in great need of more state troopers to help protect our citizens and promote safety on our highways. With a 32% decline for patrol services division in the past 18 years, and the population increasing 23%, and the number of licensed drivers in Oregon increasing 33%, and the number of miles traveled on Oregon highways has increased over 64%, this is a recipe for disaster. HJR 11 will provide the legislature with additional funding options for the state police patrol troopers for the future. This measure does not allocate any funds, nor does it have a fiscal impact on the highway fund next biennium. It only provides future funding options for legislative consideration. This resolution represents sound policy that a portion of the state highway fund safety revenues be available to support enforcement as part of our state transportation system. SJR 11 would provide the stable funding that our police in this state need and deserve. I urge immediate adoption of SJR 11 in its current form and ask you to send it directly to the floor. And I'd like to introduce Captain Williford from the State Police to talk about SJR 11. Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, good evening. For the record, I'm Captain Greg Williford, Director of the Department of Oregon State Police Patrol Services Division. I handed in some formal testimony, which has really speaks to some of the service inadequacies that we have in the agency within your patrol division due to our staffing levels. I'm going to be brief. I'll really speak to the bill that's before you today, CR 11A in growth. Essentially, what that bill does, and for the record, we certainly strongly support that bill. From the department's perspective, we believe it's a long-term option for you to fund your state police highway patrol function. It will allow a vote of the people to decide whether or not policing should be an authorized option for use of your state highway trust fund dollars, either at the state level or at the local level. Approval does not require any allocation of state highway fund dollars. It provides the state legislature with a future policy option for using a portion of those highway funds for state police patrol of state and interstate highways. Through the Ways and Means process is where that would occur at the state level. At the local level, of course, that decision to use a portion of the local share would be a local decision by county commissions or city councils. and they would decide how much, if any, would be used for local policing, same as the state legislature would decide for state policing. It currently prohibits backfilling and replacing existing police budgets with the highway fund revenues. We believe it makes good sense and good policy to have a portion of the state highway fund support enforcement in addition to engineering and education efforts for highway safety. This bill has the support of the Oregon State Police Officer Association, the Oregon Sheriff Association, and the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and we believe it's good policy and request for your support. With that, thank you.
Thank you very much. If memory serves me right, 1981 that we took the troopers out of the trust fund. Isn't that correct?
Yes, you're right. It was in the 81 when the referral went out to the people.
Okay.
We removed policing as an option along with parks funding as well.
Right, parks also. Correct. And then 1990, we voted on this again. 1992. Was that put on by the legislature when we voted on this again? Was it an initiative?
Mr. Chair, I believe the committee was by the legislature, was in, I believe, 1992.
And that was defeated also. What was the vote? Would you? Yeah.
The vote in 1992, the wording was different, but the vote for allowing future fuel taxes to go to state police was $244,173 to $451,715.
Oh, $451,000 was a
Mr. Sheriff, I may, at that time when that went out for referral, it was also tied to an increase of surcharge of $15 for vehicle registration fees as well.
Okay. Okay. We are in the middle of a debate this session about increasing fuel taxes and registration fees once again. And there's some concern about that making it out onto the ballot also if the parties that are battling on that issue. Do you think it's appropriate that we try to find new ways to spend the pot of revenue that there seems to be general consensus that isn't full enough already? I'm talking specifically about the highway trust fund because there seems to be general consensus that we don't have enough money in that fund or we wouldn't be debating an increase in the fuel tax. You adopt it and send it out, and the people that you adopt it would be yet another way to spend money out of that fund that is considered to be inadequate.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, we believe that it makes good policy sense to have a portion of the highway fund revenues be used for enforcement. You got three E's of your highway transportation strategy today in the state, and it's enforcement, engineering, and education. The enforcement fees is sorely lacking on the state level. And again, the bill does not allocate any money. It's an option only for future ways and means debate. There are needs for roadways and repair. We don't argue with that. This provides you with future funding options in addition to the general fund, which we have found to be very unstable for us, for your uniform patrol troopers. We have serious service concerns relative to responding to emergency calls for service that we are not able to do today in the patrol division. That's very, very troubling due to the inadequate staffing level that we have today.
Would that include, would you be in that same situation when we add, we provide funding for nearly 100 new troopers in this payment's budget? They don't all come on at once, but by the end of the biennium, there should be nearly 100 new fellows out there, staff to work on public safety, particularly on the highway. Do you feel that your shortfall goes significantly beyond that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do through our allocation model that we used, which was the gap analysis over the last 18 months or so. The total need identified by local communities was 416 additional uniformed troopers for your state police patrol division, and 100 is certainly welcome, but over the last 19 years we've seen a 37% decline in uniformed troopers within the the patrol division, so 100 is certainly welcome, and we will put them to work. However, the total need that we've identified through both the PAM model, which is the model we used for the last 4 years, and in the most recent allocation method of gap analysis, really looking at what communities expect state police to be doing based on what we currently have and what we're not able to do, came up to 316 additional troopers beyond the 100 that will be funded at the end of this plan.
I have had discussions with sheriffs at home and in my district, and they have expressed concern with the gap analysis that was done, and they felt that they'd be more focused on sheriffs and such, and I do appreciate the close partnership that all areas of law enforcement in our state enjoy, and I think that's very appropriate that you do. They expressed some concern with the numbers that were in the gap analysis. Their thoughts were that they were higher than what they actually needed to be. But we won't get into that in detail. But let's talk for a minute about traffic fatality statistics. Aren't the fatalities on our highways actually on the decline?
Chair, members of the committee, actually for 98, they went up from the year previous on state and interstate highways, is my understanding. For actual fatalities, those on state and interstate roadways, fatalities.
And can you provide us some that information? And go back about 8 years, 10 years.
Mr. Chair, I don't have specific numbers with me today. Trends, it seems if you look at actual numbers of people being killed on the highways, or if you look at traffic rate, which fatality rate, which reflects the miles traveled and the increase that you've seen on state and interstate highways, you see a declining fatality rate. However, if you look at the actual numbers of people being killed on state and interstate highways, that has stayed relatively the same, and at times it actually increased. We're not doing a very good job there, or either with the number of people being injured on state and interstate highways.
Then could I deduce the injuries per mile traveled as that has declined some, or fatalities per mile traveled has declined some, and maybe some due to better technology in our cars?
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. If you look at fatality rate, first factors in vehicle miles traveled, and miles traveled have gone up, you see a trend of decline. Part of that, though, relative to fatalities, is what you had mentioned, and that is we have much better trauma. We have life flight in various locations of the state we didn't have before. Cars are better engineered. Highways are engineered fairly well. We've got airbags. If you look at charts of crash data, injuries, fatalities, and relationship between the legislature passed good policy, seatbelt, for example, you see a significant decrease there in impact of seatbelt saves lives. However, we still believe strongly that 200-plus, I mean, the number of people killed on state and interstate highways, those that state police are charged to patrol, is oftentimes more than double the state homicide rate of people being killed in our local communities, and that's too many.
I just have one quick question. You talked about seatbelts and saving lives. Is there any idea how many lives would be saved if we required people with helmets in their cars?
Mr. Chair, President Sakhar, I do not have a question. Certainly would protect the hurt from trauma, but I'm not aware of any estimates on that.
Further questions from the committee? Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Sakhar.
You said your budget is the lowest this session is 0.65%. Of the general fund. What
dollar
amount?
Mr. Chair, the current for this current millennium with the 100 troopers would actually be funding for that approximately $5 million with some federal funding leverage, and of course they don't come on until the end of the biennium, so it's not a large amount, not fully funded. Is $70.9 million for the 2 year period of general fund.
So current funding levels are $70.9 million in general fund.
It's correct for the whole division.
Okay.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes.
The ODOT budget is somewhere around $2.8 billion total funds.
Chair of Ms. Conchart,
the ODOT budget, I know you're not a member of ODOT, I know that's not the audience, but ODOT's budget is around $2.8 billion.
Sure, for Ms. Conchart, I don't know.
So the patrol division is 70.9, what's the overall OSC budget?
I can give you, Mr. Chair, the 70.9 million general fund is what is in the current budget for this plan that we're in today. 82.7 million is total fund for the patrol division, 492.75 FTE. For overall agency general fund, for the overall total agency budget, is approximately $352 million for biennium.
Yeah,
all
federal
divisions, federal funds, other funds, all funds.
Okay, $352
million approximately for the biennial period. That's all funds. Mr. Chair, if I may I comment on the testimony relative to the service of traffic accident crash response? Just to remind the committee that your state police troopers are full-service law enforcement and a large role that they provide when they're out there working. The men and women provide emergency response for call for service, and on average, we are now able to respond to over 8,000 a year. On average, we have over 2,000 a year reported drunk drivers where we have no patrol available today, and that's really concerning to us.
So the emergency response, can you define that for me?
These are the calls that come into the state police dispatch center around the state for state police calls or get referred to us by other law enforcement agencies for a trooper, where we have, it's encoded that we have no one available to respond, and we, on top of those, we also refer on average around 8,000 to 9,000 to other agencies. Some of those are legitimately their calls, or the calls moved into their area, and what we believe probably about half of those are legitimate state police calls where we've had to ask for city or county, most likely county sheriff, to come up and assist.
Okay, and you mentioned if I heard you wrong, full service emergency response. What kind of things do you end up outside of situations where life is in imminent danger? Do you respond to the person sitting on the edge of the highway with their hood up?
Yes, sir.
And then and the service then is to try to get hold of AAA, okay, perhaps, or not to dive under the hood.
Right. Mr. Chair, we don't really have too many mechanics within the patrol division, but they do provide a courtesy, certainly a motion assist to a very big service responsibility that we have, providing help change tire, help call for assistance. But beyond that, there's a criminal interdiction that we're involved in. The majority of all criminal investigations and arrests that occur within the entire state police agency occur within the Patrol Services Division. Give you an idea of, there's approximately over 73,000 outstanding warrants today in the law enforcement data system. Over 18,000 of those are felony warrants. The majority of those warrants get served by police officers in uniform as a result of the traffic stop.
There's no people made by out of state. There's no Illinois in there.
Sure.
Some of those folks may be, in fact, out of state, or fled the area.
There may be.
They're fusing away unless they pick up someplace else.
Right.
Okay. I don't have any clear questions at this point to you. Okay. Thank you very much for giving birth. Mr. Pinhall, did you want to testify on the bill before us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, and we are here tonight to testify in opposition to SJR 11. Mr. Chair, as we have in the Ways and Means Committee and also in its earlier form as HGR 59. I think, as you know, Mr. Chair, we have... As we have testified before, counties are in a particularly difficult position, as well as cities are, with regard to funding for our road systems. Counties have the largest road system of all the jurisdictions. We have responsibility for 27,000 miles of roads, and over the past 10 years, we saw our revenues dwindling significantly, $60 million statewide because of the impact of the federal administration's, the current administration's policy on timber harvest, and the decline in timber harvest in the counties around the state has reduced that revenue by $60 million, significantly impacted our eastern Oregon counties, which some of them have lost as much as 80% and 90% of those revenues. And so it's become a major concern for the counties that we preserve the highway fund for road purposes. Your own legislative fiscal office earlier this year identified a shortfall for this next biennium of $132 million for counties just to maintain our existing systems and not make any improvements, just to perform the basic maintenance that's necessary, and also identify the shortfall of just the next 2 years of over $500 million with regard to maintaining and making improvements to accommodate for congestion and safety needs that growing transportation, growing vehicle miles travel is creating on the county roads. So we would be here to urge you, though we certainly recognize the need for additional policing, but we would urge that you look for that funding out of some other source and preserve the highway fund for the purpose that it currently exists, and that's for roads and bridges.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
The county's supporting the proposed fuel tax increase.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we are.
Approximately how much money, if that were to be enacted additional, would the counties receive?
Mr. Chair, we would receive about $20 to $24 million a year in additional revenues under that proposal.
22 to 24
Of the $132 million. Well, that double that. So if we look at $48 million of the $132 million,
three biennium counties would be taken care of.
Mr. Chair, that is an annual ongoing maintenance shortfall. So, yes, we would be cutting into that shortfall, but we would not be covering it totally.
Any other questions? Do you oppose this bill because it allows for state funding the police out of the state highway fund? Or does it allow funding the state police and local policing, or both, or just in both?
Mr. Chair, as you know, we offered amendments in ways and means to try to narrow this down to driver's license, a surcharge on driver's license fees, on a title, titling of automobiles and title transfers, rather than opening this up to the whole total highway fund. We're concerned about the impact that this could have, because it could in the future take a major portion of those dollars that are now flowing to roads and redirect those to state police. We have not supported, as I think you've received testimony with regard to the county sheriffs and the chiefs of police, our organization has not supported the funding even for those local government policing agencies. We feel that this money needs to remain dedicated. If the if the legislature feels that there needs to be some questions submitted to the voters, we would encourage you to narrow that significantly from opening up the whole highway fund to consideration of future transfers for policing.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Anyone else want to testify on SCR 11? Seeing none, we will close. Obviously, I'm going to work. We'll close the work session on SCR 11, and we will open a.
Mr. Chair, one card short of the form.
We will open the work session for the possible introduction of a committee bill.
Mr. Chair, there are two cards short of a quorum.
No. Can we do that?
Nope. You can't open the work session for the quorum.
You went on the top. We'll have one in a moment. There he is. Okay.
What do you do?
We close the work session on the show for others.
Okay.
And here's the show to talk about Mr. Hughes.
What's that? Okay, Mr. Hughes?
We have. Are we opening a work session?
I'm opening a work session on LP.
Possible introduction of the committee.
Okay. Open.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record and quickly, my name is Ed Hughes, speaking for Oregon Veterans, and I have permission this evening to speak for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. You have before you LC 4332, which in simple bill memorializes Congress and the President respectfully to reinstate and continue full funding of benefits and medical care for veterans of the United States Armed Forces. The bill requests a copy of this memorial be sent to the President of the United States and to each member of the Oregon Congressional Delegation. The reason for this bill is we have had numerous complaints over the past several years of the deterioration of service at the VA hospitals in Oregon and the one in Vancouver. Veterans are complaining that the service is poor. In fact, it is so poor they're having trouble even getting their medication. The deterioration comes from the fact that the administration has been cutting back in a number of areas, and also probably because there have been over the past 3 or 4 years several directors of the federal VA. The current serving director is only a temporary director at this point in time. So the deterioration of service is beginning to impact out in the states where veterans are requesting the service at the veterans hospitals in Oregon. And so we want to send a message to Congress and to the President that we would like to have full funding restored for the veterans. It's our understanding that there will be several hundred jobs eliminated at the Portland VA hospital in the near future. That's on the drawing board and that's the plan. So we're having some problems. We would like to beef up this. I'm sorry for the lateness of this bill, but this has come to our attention from the public, from the veterans themselves. And we thought, while we're still in session, maybe we ought to try to do something about it. And I appreciate the committee's indulgence staying late, and appreciate the chairs hearing the vote.
Thank you. Is this suggested a House resolution? Which is only has to go through the House, doesn't have to go to the Senate.
Representative Pinnell started doing this thing.
Yeah, he did a resolution, I think, so.
It was a House memorial. It passed the House.
Yeah, because the thing that's kept, I would take them along the wrong run as a joint memorial.
Okay. Actually, the Senate isn't doing this. They're doing a letter instead of a memorial. So the Senate is taking action on this as well. No, they're just on their side, and we're just doing ours.
Mr. Chair, your staff did have communication today with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and they fully support this particular memorial.
Mr. Blair. The rightness of the hour, would it be as effective if we did a letter and we all signed it? All six together, perhaps?
Over in the Senate, the Senator Starr is using that approach. I'll leave that to the committee.
And with the effect in Washington, D.C., the people who listen back there, I did get a letter back from Greg Walden saying he had received some memorials and resolutions based on certain issues. Which is the first notification I've heard from anybody back there about that they received anything, such as that the expressions of opinion that we expressed to Washington, D.C. through memorials and resolutions during this process. And, so I was heartened by that response from him. But do you have any particular opinion on what would be elicit the most positive response or reaction from the folks back there?
Well, I most certainly think a letter signed by most, if not all, of the House members would probably be a little different approach, might gain more attention than a memorial, but it's really up to Representative Starr. It's, you know, his request. And, we will cooperate with anything the committee wants to do.
Okay, thank you very much, sir. Appreciate that. Representative Manning.
Perhaps we ought to give a memorial to Representative Walden, thanking him for reading our
report. For reading our stuff and responding to it. Yeah, that's kind of a novel idea, isn't it? For the discussion.
Do we have a motion, Mr. Chair?
We do not.
Well, it's the motion that we need.
The motion begins, and if we want to try to do a letter and circulate it around in caucus, it wouldn't take but a minute.
Would you rather do that, Mr. Chair, than even this route?
That would be, it would stand out from a memorial or resolution, and if we all had actually signed our names to it.
Mr. Chairman?
I'd
encourage that route. I think that we could prepare a letter on the House speakers or House stationery and have signature lines for the 60 representatives. I'd dare any one of them up to sign it in a whiz. It'd be very effective to have a letter signed by 60 people.
60 elected officials in the state of Oregon.
I would,
it might assist us, if I may, also in dealing with issues arising out of new legislation at this stage of the process.
Well, this didn't get here by accident.
Oh, no. I'm just saying that, I appreciate that.
Okay.
No, all channels have been followed. I'm not suggesting otherwise.
But I would, whatever the committee chooses, either way would be, maybe just as well to the letter.
You can get a letter done faster than a memorial.
I should pick it because I already have their letter done to me.
When's the last comment?
The Senate, I don't know if every senator signed the letter in the Senate, but I saw a sheet that had more than half of them
already signed on to it. So maybe some chance we have a letter finished by tomorrow.
Sure.
Well, why don't we pursue that?
Do that.
At least till through lunch tomorrow, and if you're not going very well, then we have this more afternoon.
Okay. That's right.
Okay. We will close the duration of possible adoption of committee bills and ask that you put SDR 11 on the schedule again for tomorrow. We need to have our Democrats here for that.
Good morning.
In the afternoon. And we will meet at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning for consideration of 686. And try to get that finished before the floor session 10 o'clock.
We're not going to do 1511 petitions anymore?
Not tonight. No. So we will then, until 9 o'clock tomorrow, we'll be posted at 8. It may take us every bit of that time to get through the prison siting issue. So if we'll try to be promptly at 9 o'clock. And I will try to be promptly here myself at 9 o'clock.
Oh.
Okay. Why don't we, we can adjourn to the talk to you off the record, all four of us, anyway.
Wait a minute. Okay. We wanted to reconsider the vote by which we moved 1533 by the people.
I know.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there a problem with 13, what?
1333. Yes. Yeah, there is a problem with 1333 because Eugene Williams has found the vote to adopt the minority report.
That wasn't today.
It was yesterday. We didn't go to it on the floor yesterday.
What was
1333 after that? That's
one of the new LIDs. Oh, I'm just retroactive part of the title. Can we bring that up tomorrow in the morning?
Just a minute, if you have suspension, I believe
if we do,
we already have agreement for suspension.
Yeah.
We will, if you know the business for us, we will adjourn.
Thank you.